ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a New South Wales police officer charged with a double murder as investigators continue their search for the bodies of the alleged victims. Also, as a by-election approaches, what's behind a new advertising campaign attacking the Albanese government? And on the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, a plea to Australians.
If Ukraine loses to Putin, then the whole world will lose to Putin. Then Putin will show that his ideology is much stronger, and that would be a huge threat to even to countries as distant as Australia.
First tonight, a New South Wales police officer has been charged with murdering two people in an inner Sydney suburb. Detectives are still searching for the bodies of the alleged victims. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Days into the search for a Sydney couple last seen in the suburb of Paddington on Sunday evening, a major development.
The update is, at this stage, charges have been submitted for two counts of murder.
Detective Superintendent Daniel Doherty confirming that a 28-year-old police officer is accused of a double murder. Former TV presenter Jesse Baird and his partner Luke Davies appeared to have vanished. Some clues were left behind. There was the discovery of some of their possessions in a skip bin, clothing covered in blood, as well as a large amount of blood in one of their homes in Paddington. The search for the victims' bodies is now the investigators' main focus.
That's the priority. I think that's a priority for us. Just our focus and money for the family. Look, again, they've got mixed emotions about the whole thing. We need to find that not only for the breadth of evidence and the cause of death, the main focus for us is trying to find answers for the family.
The accused is New South Wales Police Constable Beau Lamar. Police have discovered what they're calling a projectile at the premises in Paddington, and their ballistics report has matched it to a police gun.
It's been documented that the 28-year-old man facing these charges was in a relationship with Jesse some time ago, which finished a couple of months ago, and so that'll be a obvious line of inquiry in relation to him in a domestic style incident.
Detective Superintendent Doherty says the men were last seen on Sunday night and they likely died sometime on Monday. Then on Monday night, a white van was hired from the suburb of Mascot. It's now been located and investigators believe it was used to transport the bodies. There are multiple crime scenes at Waterloo and Balmain. There's also a crime scene in a suburban area of Newcastle. Cadaver dogs and officers are hunting for clues.
It's really important that we do locate the bodies, not only for the cause of death, but also for the answers for the family, because they're still grieving and they're starting to grieve now.
Constable Lamar presented himself to Bondi Police Station shortly after 10:30 this morning, although police were already trying to find him by that time. He will be formally refused bail by police.
Alexandra Humphreys. Tomorrow will mark 2 years since Russian troops stormed into eastern Ukraine, starting a war that the United Nations estimates has killed at least 10,000 civilians. In the first few months of the conflict, thousands of Ukrainians were granted temporary visas to live in Australia. They've started to feel comfortable with their new life here, but as Angus Randall reports, many could be forced to return to their homeland when their visas expire next year.
At Adelaide's Ukrainian Community Centre, children who fled to Australia when the Russian invasion began are thinking back to that first day of war.
I woke up early and I saw my mum was shocked. I asked her what's happened. She said the war started. I couldn't believe my eyes.
When my mum said that war started and I asked, do I need to go to school? Yeah, and she said, obviously no. The first day we went to the store and everything, like there was nothing. There were only like cigarettes and chews, gums. And then when we went back home, We did not have any lights or water.
Since the war began, the federal government has granted visas to more than 11,000 refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. Those who settled in Adelaide are grateful to be calling Australia home.
We thought it would be for 3 days, but now it's 2 years.
I felt very happy because it was sunny. I was dreaming about sun.
So sunny country and so many different people from other countries, and makes me feel better and good that I'm not only one different here.
Trudy Mitchell is the CEO of Australia for UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency. She says 40% of those who remain in Ukraine need humanitarian aid.
It's resulted in 2 million homes that have been bombed, at least 10,000 people who have been killed, and there are currently almost 6.5 million refugees from Ukraine who have sought refuge globally, while some 3.7 million people remain forcibly displaced internally within Ukraine. Please don't forget what's going on in the other side of the world.
Zofia came to Australia 5 months after the invasion started with her mother and daughter. Her father, husband and son have all stayed behind. Her son is 20 years old and he enlisted in the military when the war began.
My son fighting all the time. A lot of his friends died and it's very difficult for him, for friends' parents.
Zofia was a doctor in Ukraine, but it's been a battle to get her Ukrainian qualifications recognised, and she only started learning English when she arrived in Australia.
Here difficult because here I'm zero. You know, in my country I'm doctor.
Katerina Ardru is the co-chair of the Australian Federation of Ukrainian Organisations. She says Zofia tells a familiar story.
In Ukraine they would have been, you know, doctors, engineers, professors, IT specialists. Here they're having to not only deal with settling after experiencing the traumas of war, but then they also need to get their English up to scratch to make sure that they pass the relevant tests and then obviously enter the workforce. And there's also an element of qualification recognition. So sometimes their degrees are not recognized, even if they have 2 or 3 degrees.
Another challenge on the horizon is uncertainty over how long Ukrainian refugees will be allowed to stay in Australia. Their temporary humanitarian visas only last 3 years.
Not only is the war raging, the humanitarian 786 visas are also coming up to expiry. So the displaced Ukrainians that are here, which mostly 70% of are women and children, they basically are facing a lot of anxiety and uncertainty about their future, whether they will be forced to go back home. And for them, back home is currently a raging war zone. Some people don't have anything to go back to as their homes have been destroyed.
What are the pathways for getting permanency?
Right now, the only lifeline that they really have is this 3-year visa that's coming to an end. There is no pathway to permanent residency right now. So that is one area that we are hoping the government will explore and provide that option for those that wish to stay.
The Home Affairs Department says it's progressing visa applications from Ukrainian nationals as a priority, particularly for those with a connection to Australia. It says those who wish to extend their stay can access standard visa pathways, including the skilled, family, student and visitor visa programs. It says those who fear harm if they return to Ukraine can apply for a protection visa. Ahead of tomorrow's 2-year anniversary, Katerina Ardru wants to thank Australians who welcomed displaced Ukrainians into their community.
I can't speak about Ukrainians in Australia without mentioning and expressing the sheer gratitude that the community feels towards everyday Australians that have opened up their arms and hearts and welcomed these displaced Ukrainians to Australia.
The anniversary is being commemorated with rallies in most major cities tomorrow.
Angus Randall reporting. When Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, some observers predicted the nation would be unable to resist the massive fighting forces of the Putin regime for long. But Ukrainians have put up an extraordinary fight. Eva Sonsun is a member of the Ukrainian parliament. She spoke to me from Kyiv and I asked her how her compatriots are feeling ahead of the anniversary tomorrow.
People are exhausted. People are tired. People are extremely
exhausted that it does not seem to be moving anywhere. But the level of support in terms of weapons we are getting does not allow us to move any further in terms of regaining control of our territory. So I think that this feeling of being tired and exhausted is probably the prevailing one. It does not mean, however, that people are ready to give up, because after everything that we have witnessed as a country, as a society, people want to see justice being done. But the truth is, of course, that living through this terrible war is exhausting for everybody, for families, for individuals, especially for those who have their loved ones on the front line.
Are Ukrainians getting a feeling that the focus is more on the Middle East now, and you're feeling a lack of support because of that focus being elsewhere?
Well, I think that the focus is first, of course, shifted to the Middle East to a big extent, but I also think that internal politics in major partner countries, including the United States, of course, is also something that is largely influencing the support to Ukraine. So what we are concerned is not so much that the attention has shifted towards the Middle East, but bigger problem is, of course, that in the United States, it's the political process, the electoral process is taking place, and that unfortunately the issue of support to Ukraine has become part of that process. And I would say that this is the bigger concern for us rather than shifting focus to the Middle East.
American aid to Ukraine is being held up by disputes between US lawmakers. How closely are Ukrainians watching that dispute?
Well, I'll tell you this. The news from the Congress are taking up a huge portion of the media coverage of the news in Ukraine. I think that issue is being discussed probably even more in depth than the news from the Ukrainian parliament, because the truth is that our livelihoods depend on this help. We get up to 70% of military aid from the United States, and the fact that it is not being delivered right now is already having an impact on the front line. Already, after several months of those delays, our military men and women see that they lack weapons which were supposed to have been delivered through the as the result of this help, but because of this holdup in the Congress, unfortunately, it is not being delivered. And the biggest problem, of course, is that this time that is being used for discussions and debates in the American Congress, the Russians are using this time to build up their arsenal. And unfortunately, for half a year of this delay, they have managed to use this time very, very wisely and strategically by building up their reserves. And we are already in huge disparity on the front line. We never have been equal, but now the situation got much worse than it was even half a year ago.
What will it mean for Ukraine if Donald Trump is elected US president in November?
Well, of course, we do hope that American democracy will prove strong once again, and that not a single leader can change the course of the whole country, and that American interests still lie in supporting Ukraine, and that the rest of the government in the US will understand that. But of course, we see it as a huge risk. The rhetoric that he is using right now is extremely dangerous, and we see it as a huge unpredictable factor in American politics, but also it is extremely unpredictable for us here, particularly given the extent to which we depend upon the American military aid. So we hope that American democracy will stand and will still support the American national interests, which I'm absolutely sure is in fighting against this autocratic regime in Russia. But of course, this is the biggest threat that we are facing this year, probably.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been an extraordinary advocate for your country. You're from an opposition party, I know, but does he still have the strong support of the people?
Well, his support is still over 60%, which is quite high. It is slowly dropping, but not rapidly, not like Putin claims it to be. So there is still great sense of unity in the society. And of course, this leads people to continue to support the president, who has been standing with the Ukrainian people. So yes, his support is still great. I would say that the support for the Ukrainian armed forces is even higher. And I think those are the people that that enjoy the greatest level of support. But yes, support for the president is still pretty high.
Finally, Ms. Sovsen, do you have a message for Australians as we approach this second anniversary, those Australians who may have lost interest in what's happening in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, I want to thank all Australians because quite unexpectedly for all of us here, Australia has been a great supporter to Ukraine, and you delivering military and humanitarian aid has been very much appreciated over here in Ukraine. But I would say that for those who are forgetting about this, I think the reminder would be that unfortunately, even though if you don't see it on the news every day, the situation in Ukraine is not much better than it was 2 years ago when the whole world united around Ukraine. The situation for those Ukrainian soldiers in the trenches right now is the same as it was two years ago. It is still terrifying reality of war that Ukraine did nothing to provoke, a war that was completely unjustified, but we still continue to fight it, and we fight it not just for us, but for the rest of the Western civilization, and we hope that people will remember that Putin is not just a threat to Russia. Putin aims to undermine democracy, liberal world order in on the whole globe, and thus the whole civilized world should be standing together with Ukraine, because if Ukraine loses to Putin, then the whole world will lose to Putin. Then Putin will show that his ideas, his ideology is much stronger. And that would be a huge threat to even to countries as distant as Australia.
Ina Sovsen, a member of the Ukrainian Parliament, speaking to me from Kyiv. 3 years on from Victoria's Royal Commission into Mental Health, homelessness groups say a recommendation to provide 500 supporting housing places for young people hasn't been met. They say that help is needed desperately as people with mental health problems are struggling more than ever to find homes in the current rental crisis. Oliver Gordon reports.
25-year-old Tyler knows what it's like to be homeless.
I was homeless from the age of 21 up until a few months ago.
The experience was harrowing.
I showered at truck stops and then, charged my phone, sometimes at truck stops, sometimes at libraries, healthy food that it just wasn't an option. There is nowhere to cook. There is no way to eat healthy to sustain yourself. So it was lots of fast food, lots of just getting by.
At their lowest point, Tyler attempted suicide.
There was just nowhere for me to be safe. And if there's nowhere for you to go to be safe, it feels like the only way out is to die.
In 2021, the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system recommended 500 new supported housing places for young people experiencing homelessness and living with mental health issues. But almost 3 years after the recommendation was handed down, Melbourne City Mission's Shauna Moore says the commitment hasn't been met.
We're seeing many homeless young people experiencing such serious mental health crisis that they need care in emergency departments. And worse still, it's often the case that they are discharged from the hospital and dropped back at our Youth Homelessness Access Point front yard, youth services. And these are children as young as 16 who are completely alone, and the cycling in and out of the emergency department and the homelessness access points is constant. And as a result, we are seeing very high rates of self-harm and suicide among this group, tragically.
And is it worse than you've seen it ever before?
Yes.
Council to Homeless Persons CEO Deborah Di Natale says the 500 new places, should they be provided, would be filled instantly.
What we're asking for is 500 social houses, so 500 homes across Victoria. What we say around that is a really small ask, considering that in Victoria around 11,200 young people are seeking support from a homelessness service.
In 2020, 1 year before the Mental Health Royal Commission handed down its recommendations, the Victorian government committed $5 billion to delivering 12,000 new social and affordable homes. Deborah Di Natale says the housing recommended by the Royal Commission should be in addition to this.
We're not asking to say we want you to take this away. We're saying we want you to make a commitment that you already made in a Royal Commission recommendation to provide specific housing for young people. You need supports when you have got mental health challenges as a young person. And the best thing we can do to ensure that the trajectory for our young people gets better is to ensure that we get them housed.
Tyler agrees. After 4 years of homelessness, they've found a place, but they're worried about many of their mates who are still sleeping rough.
If you want our young people, our most vulnerable people, to have a chance to be able to grow and to be okay in the way that we want for all of our children, you have to give them a safe place to land.
That report from Oliver Gordon. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline. That number is 13 11 14. And in a statement, the Victorian government said it had built more than 2,000 homes for Victorians with mental illness, including an investment of more than $50 million to deliver housing for young people experiencing homelessness. Well, some political commentators describe the lobby group Advance as the Conservative answer to Australia's left-wing campaign group GetUp, and they point to the significant role it played in the No campaign in last year's Voice referendum. Now Advance is setting its sights on helping unseat Labor in next weekend's federal by-election in the Melbourne electorate of Dunkley. Jacqueline Breen reports.
Full-page newspaper ads in Melbourne this week had big headlines reading rapist, pedophiles and murderers. Under that, a picture of a frowning Anthony Albanese and the claim that Albo had unlocked the doors of immigration detention and paid lawyers to argue for the release of criminals. It's a reference to last year's High Court ruling on indefinite immigration detention. The ad makes a bold claim, but what should we make of it? Former journalist and ANU professor Mark Kenny puts it bluntly.
By any normal community usage of the term lie, that is a lie. We know that the government's lawyers argued indeed in the High Court for a different outcome from the one that they got. It was the court that decided that the indefinite detention was unlawful, and that led to those people being released.
The group called Advance first emerged after the same-sex marriage campaign in 2018 and counts former Liberal Prime Minister Tony Abbott among its past advisers. Now, fresh from claiming what it calls a victory in last year's Voice referendum, Advance is back. It's funding ads, leaflets and mobile billboards in the electorate of Dunkley, telling voters to put Labor last in next Saturday's by-election. Most of the action is on social media, where it's so far outspent the official Liberal Party campaign, according to Professor Andrea Carson from La Trobe University.
In the last 30 days, they've spent about $26,000, which compares to the Labor Party, which is also throwing a lot of resources at this. They've spent $47,000 and then another $8,000 with their candidate, Jody Bollier. So we can see that Advance has been quite prominent. They've also been able to fundraise effectively, bringing in over $5 million that we know of so far in the last financial year, which was up from about $2 million during the last federal election in 2022. And there could be more because the full disclosures for the referendum won't be released until April.
The Dunkley by-election is the group's first test since its role in the Voice referendum campaign, where Professor Carson believes it was able to cut through, especially online, especially on TikTok. Like GetUp, the group isn't publicly affiliated with a political party, the Liberals or Nationals, which Mark Kenny believes is no accident.
The advantage for the Liberal Party, for the coalition of having Advance, is that Advance, a bit like the super PACs in America that are separate from the official campaign, can be less constrained by the rules of decency, basically, decency, truth, accuracy and the like. They can use hyperbole and exaggeration really at will. They can benefit the coalition without the coalition having to be accountable for what is essentially a pretty flagrant lie.
So far, Labor's strategy is to call the campaign misinformation and American, comparing it with the politics of Donald Trump. Former Liberal adviser Tony Barry, who's now with polling group Redbridge, also sees similarities with the states.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in Australian politics with this increased tribalism and fragmentation is we're seeing effectively super PACs. Clive Palmer was the first super PAC, a one-man super PAC. The Teals was also a super PAC, effectively.
But he says he thinks Advance's impact is being overstated.
Oh, I think they've done very well in the self-promotion and publicity of their campaign. But whether that's translating to shifting votes on the ground, I haven't seen any evidence of that yet. Labor's got a bit of fat in their vote. They had 40% primary vote in Dunkley last time. That was largely due to a very popular local member and a mood for change in the broader electorate with Scott Morrison. Whether they can maintain that level of 40% remains to be seen, but the truth of it is they've got a lot of fat in that vote. They can afford to lose, you know, 5 points pretty comfortably.
In a statement, Advance says every single word in its newspaper ad is a fact, and it provided a link to an article about the government allowing the Australian Human Rights Commission to take the indefinite detention case to the High Court.
Jacqueline Breen reporting. Well, for the first time, a private company has successfully landed a spacecraft on the moon. The vessel, called Odysseus, will spend the next 7 days on the moon conducting experiments. Here's Elizabeth Cramsey.
The Odysseus lander is 4 metres tall, 1.5 metres wide, and standing on 6 legs. It will spend the next 7 days gathering data on the challenges spacecraft face when landing on the moon. One of the elements posing the biggest risks for missions is moon dust. Associate Professor Alice Gorman is a space archaeologist at Flinders University.
The dust was really sticky. It was electrostatically charged, just like when, you know, you rub a balloon against a woolen jumper. So the dust is charged, it sticks to everything. It's really sharp and abrasive. It has razor-sharp, tiny, tiny particles all through it. There's never been any water on the moon to sort of soften those edges out like beach sand.
Since the Apollo missions in the 1960s, concerns have been raised over those tiny particles.
And even on the couple of hours the Apollo 11 astronauts were on the moon, they started to notice that it could potentially do things like wear away at the seals on their suits, which would breach them and make them breathe in lunar nothingness, and that it clogged up equipment, made things difficult to operate, and it made visibility very low. The astronauts on all 6 Apollo missions also observed how landing and taking off blew this dust over quite long distances. So we know that the dust is going to get everywhere, stick to things, and potentially stop equipment from working.
And there are a few experiments on Odysseus to see how that could be managed.
One was it had cameras attached to its legs so it could get images of what was happening with the dust in that process of descending and actually landing. So this is really critical information we haven't had. And the Eagle camera, which was a student-run, student-created experiment, also had procedure for trying to repel the dust. So the dust is charged, so if you use an opposite charge, you can potentially make it not stick. You can make it vanish. It literally won't stick because it's the wrong charge. So they had a little experiment to see if you could stop the dust from sticking.
Dr. Brad Tucker is an astronomer at the Australian National University. He says today's moon landing is an exciting development.
It's a new way of going about business in space. We've seen how private companies have allowed quicker, cheaper access into space around the Earth. What used to cost tens of thousands of dollars per kilogram to take to the International Space Station now only costs $1,000 to $2,000. And with so many more groups going, we can send more experiments and do more science. And now this is the new view of what we can do with the moon. Instead of waiting for a few national agencies to send a mission or people, you can send multiple of these landers and probes, getting more experiments and opening up all the science that we can do on the moon.
Dr. Brad Tucker ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by David Sargent, Lena El-Sadi and Joel Kassam. I'm Samantha Donovan. The PM team will be back on Monday evening. And don't forget, you can find all our reports and interviews on the PM website. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For more than a decade, Julian Assange has tried everything to avoid the position he finds himself in now, on the cusp of being bundled onto a plane to the US to face espionage charges. His fate now rests with a couple of judges in London. Today, media freedom advocate Peter Gresta unpacks his case for us. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.